ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
It is only 90 minutes away, but when comparing Chicago to Milwaukee, the differences between the two cities are obviously huge. However, that does not mean that there aren't some features in the Windy City that might serve as an example for improving some Milwaukee neighborhoods. On this edition of UWM Today, we're joined by a UWM professor who has taken an in-depth look at a Chicago institution, block clubs. What are they, and what have they meant to the quality of life in many areas of Chicago? Amanda Seligman, a historian and chair of UWM's History Department, is here to explain. Welcome, Amanda. Good to have you on today's program.
Thanks so much, Tom.
You've just written a book about block clubs in Chicago because you, I think, as I understand the story, discovered there's a whole lot to say about this institution.
I was really surprised. When I first started working on this project, I didn't even know it was a separate project. I didn't realize that it was something that needed to be explained. I was in graduate school in the 90s, and I was doing my research on my dissertation. And the topic that I was working on, block clubs just kept showing up in the research I was doing. And so I dutifully took notes on what I was finding and went on with my other project and just thought that block clubs were part of the fabric of the city of Chicago. Then a couple years later, as I was finishing up that book, I did a little bit more research and I said, you know what, I have some stuff on block clubs here. Let me see what else exists out there in the scholarly literature. So I did some research and I found there was actually almost nothing on block clubs. There was a dissertation here and a master's thesis there, but there was nothing that had really been published except for in tiny little journals or just little excerpts of stories. It's like, oh, I really know something that nobody else seems to know. Let me write about it. So I started to write an article and I wrote, and I had 13,000 words, and it was really dense. And I thought, wow, this is much more than an article because it was already twice as long as a journal article should be. Why don't I just call this a book and expand it so that it's not so packed together? And I just kept writing. And actually, I used my sabbatical a couple years ago to expand the whole thing into, you know, the 75,000-word manuscript that it eventually became. And what I found in the course of doing the project is that block clubs are special in Chicago. They are, as an alderman's staff member told me, they're part of our DNA. They have a really special history in Chicago. They exist in lots of other cities. One person found 10,000 of them in New York City at one point. Well, she tried to find them. She knew there were 10,000, but she couldn't locate all of them. And they exist in lots of, especially Midwestern cities, but nobody had studied them. So what I tried to do in this book was to really figure out where they came from, how to organize them, what they can do, what their limits are, and what they mean for life in the city.
Well, let's talk about that. Where did they come from? The notion of having a club of that's made up of what people living on the same block?
That's right. So it's helpful to start with the definition of what a block club is. So when I go to Chicago, people all know. And when I go to other places, they're like, well, I know what those words in that order mean, but I don't really know what a block club is. Another way to think about it is a block association. It's exactly as you said, people who live on the same block, which whether it's facing blocks or a square block or maybe two blocks together, when they get together and have an organization and work to improve whatever they see as the problems in their neighborhood, whether that's the alley needs to be cleaned up or there's rowdy kids on the corner who need to be quieted down, or whether they just want to have a sort of a party to celebrate the fact that they know each other and enjoy each other's company.
Now in your book, you note that while there are social aspects mm-hmm. to block clubs, in Chicago, it goes one or two or maybe three levels deeper than that. It's not just getting together for a beer because you've seen the person on the other side of your fence.
Right. In some parts of the city, all they have is a block party where they'll close off the block for the day and they'll all bring out the food and the music and the bubbles or whatever the kids want to play with and celebrate for the day. But block clubs do a lot more than that. They, as I said, work on whatever the neighbors think are the problems, and they organize themselves in a very low budget but sometimes high energy way to solve those problems. So if they think that the street is dirty, well, how are we going to clean the street? Let's get everybody out at the same time, and we're going to do the raking, and we're going to pick up the trash, and we're going to then we'll have the truck come through and wash the street afterwards, and it'll look really good. And there's going to be a synergy in that, because we'll know that there's more than just one lonely person fixing their house and feeling that, oh, well, I've done this, but it's not making any real change. But look, if you all get together, you can make an improvement that everyone can see has results. And if we do it frequently enough, they'll look like they're lasting results.
How many Black clubs are there in Chicago?
Well, that's a great question, Tom. So I do want to back up and give you the history. But to answer that question directly, the maximum number of Black clubs there ever were was during World War II, when, as part of the Civil Defense Program, every block in not just the city but the region was organized, and there were 20,000 block club captains sworn in. Yeah, it's an enormous amount. 16,000 or so of those were in the city, and then the rest in places like Gary and the other surrounding suburbs. Now it's really hard to count them because one of the things I found out about block clubs is that they come in and out of existence. They're ephemeral. They are very easy to start, which means they're also very easy to stop. And it takes a lot of energy on the part of the volunteers to keep them going. So it's really hard to count how many there are at any given moment. And I actually, since I'm not a quantitative scholar, I didn't try to count, although I'm hoping I can find a quantitative collaborator who will help me be a little bit more definitive about that. I would guess that at any given moment in the city, there's probably 1,000 that are operative. The Chicago Police Department has organize them as part of the community policing practices that have been in place through the broken windows theory since the 90s. But they're not really great about releasing information about the extent of their operation. So I know that they had, when I interviewed somebody on their staff, they had 24 organizers. And an organizer can handle 10 or 20 block clubs at any given time.
This is people working for the police department?
Civilians who work for the police department as organizers, yes. In fact, I think CPD is probably the biggest community organizer in Chicago history, which is kind of mind-blowing when you think about it. And then, so there probably are several hundred CPD block clubs, but I don't know for sure because I haven't ever seen the numbers.
Are there any political roots to the block clubs in what has, you know, been known as a heavily Democratic city over the last century?
Well, that is such an interesting question, and it's one that actually the peer review process changed my mind about or helped me think about how to understand it differently. So block clubs really started through the Urban League. First, the National Urban League, which founded them in other cities, New York, Atlanta, St. Louis, Pittsburgh, and because the block clubs were spreading through their network, they also naturally made their way to Chicago. And the Urban League was really at the forefront of block club organizing in the teens and the 20s, less so in the 20s, and the 30s in Chicago. And the Urban League had a very strong apolitical stance. Their purpose was to help African-American migrants acclimate to the urban north, so that they wouldn't embarrass their longstanding neighbors who maybe had some more sophistication because they'd been in the North longer, or so they thought. And then also that part of the mission was to prove to whites that African Americans were perfectly respectable people that you might want to have as your neighbors, or at least you might want to employ. So they organized a lot of block clubs as part of that effort to show that African Americans were perfectly good neighbors in the North. And then they got picked up, as I suggested, during the civilian defense effort in World War II. See, I'm going into the history now. I can't resist.
Well, you're a historian.
That's right. And then what happened was after the war, they got picked up by the Urban League started organizing them again very prominently. And then the Hyde Park Kenwood Community Conference, which was an interracial group on the south side of Chicago that was trying to get urban renewal into the University of Chicago area, started organizing them. And the Urban League got a little defensive. They said, hey, we thought of this. But what the organizers at Hyde Park Kenwood Community Conference did was not only organize them, but sort of spread the gospel of block clubs throughout Chicago. So they went around and talked about what it was that they were doing and why they were doing it. And lots of other organizations in the 50s and early 60s that were trying to bring urban renewal to their neighborhoods also started organizing them. That's how they spread around Chicago. And then they get picked up by Saul Alinsky-style groups, because Alinsky's Industrial Area Foundation was in Chicago and working, and there were lots of organizers in his tradition there. They also, very interestingly, got picked up by anti-black white groups. So there were some
So they were started originally to help the black community to grow and prosper, but then used against them later?
Yes. This is one of the things I say in the book is that a black club is not does not have an intrinsic agenda, right? A black club is a form that that people can use to further whatever their ends are. So one group in the 50s and another in the 60s used black clubs as a way of sending a signal to African Americans that they were not welcome in the neighborhood. And then, fascinatingly, CPD picks them up as part of their version of the community policing in the 90s.
Wow, fascinating. As you take a look at the expansion of black clubs in a big metropolitan area, I think population of city of Chicago now is, what, about 7.5 million people or so? I think the metro area, the
metro
broader
area.
Area, is actually over 9 million. So it's a great, great big area. Were you surprised that clubs, organizations, units of people really down at the really grassroots level would spring up in the numbers that they did in this great big urban area where you would think nobody would know anyone and, you know, it would seem very anonymous in a city of millions.
Right. Well, you've tapped into one of those fundamental questions of urban scholarship, which is how do people in an urban space relate? Are they essentially strangers or do they find ways to make connections? That goes back to Tonier's and the question of Gesellschaft versus Gemeinschaft. Is there society or is there community in the city? And the answer has always traditionally been that there's society, but there is not community. But scholars who dig into it find that people on the ground, in fact, do know the people that they live near and do have connections with them, not always as intimately as they might with their families or their people that they work with, but in a way that matters to their lives. And so I think that what I show in this book and what black clubs demonstrate is that people do relate to their neighbors, not always perfectly. There's tension running throughout this book, but they do definitely see and interact with and are affected by the people who live near them in a way that means that they have to figure out some way of relating to them.
You found so many different aspects of how life is better or changed because of these clubs. And I know that in your book you have a passage that perhaps you could share with us that talks about the way in which something maybe more akin to the countryside was introduced in terms of gardens.
Oh, thank you. I'd love to share this passage. This is from chapter 4. One of the things that black clubs did was when they noticed vacant lots, and they were troubled by vacant lots because people hung out in them who were kind of unsavory, or they broke glass, or they did drugs. They tried to change those vacant lots into something that would be a little bit more appealing. So in many places, they built gardens. And in this one block on the west side of Chicago, they built 5 gardens just in the space of one block. And I just wanted to share 2 paragraphs about the process of making gardens. So here I go. One of the first obstacles to gardening on vacant city lots was the poor quality of the soil. The club tried to remedy its deficiencies. Faith Rich attempted to create compost with enough nutrients to grow healthy plants. She buried her garbage next door to her home in the hope of helping a neighbor's vegetable garden. The block club voted to include leaves in the compost, since the addition of yard waste to kitchen refuse makes for more fecund soil. Rich asked the Chicago Department of Streets and Sanitation and the Chicago Park District to contribute dead leaves to the effort. Because the block club abutted Douglas Park, one of the city's largest parks, suitable leaves were not far away. But she found that they, quote, could not dump leaves on private property without specific permission from the city, end quote. The city refused to help identify the property owners so that the block club could seek their cooperation. In one case, a frustrated Rich later discovered, the city itself owned the lot. Further, when the block club members had their soil tested in 1986, they found excessive levels of cadmium contamination. This discovery sent them to the University of Illinois Cooperative Extension Program for information about which vegetables could be safely grown and consumed. The group also took advantage of an offer from the Metropolitan Sanitary District of Greater Chicago for free sludge. As a result of this difficulty in obtaining soil good enough for gardening, the 15th Place Block Club urged the city to update its laws so that building wreckers would be required to leave 3 inches of soil on the site of a wrecked building. Despite the troubles with the soil, the 15th Place Block Club ultimately supported 5 vacant lot gardens on its block. Rich wrote, "At first, most of the people thought I was crazy, and only the children worked with me, picking up the stones and planting the seeds. But then some things grew. Many more began to be interested, and a few actually worked so that the last year I did hardly anything." The gardening effort attracted several older men on the block. Rich described them in loving, wry detail in a letter to her sister. Two men, both tenants in the Kedzie building, a 24-apartment building on one corner of our block, became interested in the garden and go out there as early as 6 o'clock in the morning, I am told. They spaded it up and planted it. One of the men doesn't really do any work because he has a bad heart and is not supposed to lift a finger to do anything, but he contributes companionship for the other man and a great many ideas, many of them inconvenient. He goes out and buys things for the garden. He often says he spends much more for liquor, and why shouldn't he put the money in a garden instead? Why indeed?
What a wonderful, wonderful portrait of how these clubs could bring people out of their buildings, out of their apartments, and into life together.
That's right. It definitely does pull the people out of their homes and into relationships.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. So good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack, and joining us in the studio is Professor Amanda Seligman. Amanda is the chair of the history department at UWM and recently just authored a book just published on Chicago's block clubs, How Neighbors Shape the City. Amanda, as we talk about this fascinating piece of Chicago history, I have to ask about the way in which it might provide a lesson or some instruction for us here in Milwaukee. Have you seen any sort of similarities in terms of Milwaukee's own history? Have we had block clubs the same way that Chicago has in our past?
Well, there definitely have been block clubs, and they came right out of that Urban League tradition. So I had a student several years ago who was working with the Milwaukee Urban League papers and wrote a paper about block clubs in Milwaukee. That was actually part of how I got going with this project. They're special in Chicago because they've been taken up so frequently by so many kinds of organizations that it's natural in the landscape, whereas people in other places like Milwaukee think they know what they are but haven't seen them in action. But I think they definitely have potential for a city like Milwaukee. They're, as I suggested, they're very easy to start. There's, you know, if you go online, there's sample organization manuals. There's charters, so you don't even have to sort of write your own constitution. You can just borrow the constitution and plug in the name of your street. They're not so elaborate that you even have to register them with the city or with the state because they're too small to really be nonprofit organizations, even though they are nonprofit. If you charge people $10 a year dues, your budget is very small. It's not really a sort of an organization that needs to be recognized as part of the tax system. The difficulty with block clubs is that they're hard to sustain, and this is why block club organizing is most successful, as far as I can tell from my research, when it's done from the top, when there's a larger organization that's dedicated to making sure the block club keeps going. So if the leader gets sick, they help the block club find somebody else who will take over. And we'll suggest strategies and activities and also connect them with other like-minded organizations to do some larger projects as well. So I think that they have a lot of potential for a place like Milwaukee. They're not expensive. They can have a lot of good effects, building community as well as actually changing the physical environment. But it does require some commitment to keep them going.
And also commitment from the city. And in the passage that you read just a moment ago, you described the tension that existed between some portions of city government who said, we're not going to give you the names of who owns this property, go away, essentially. And yet you also pointed out earlier that the Chicago Police Department itself discovered that this could be a key to creating a safer city.
Yeah, that's right. That's one of the reasons that community policing in Chicago is different from, say, a city like New York. So in New York, community policing is really encapsulated by the controversial stop and frisk policy, right? The idea was that to get rid of small crimes as a way of counteracting big crimes from happening. And that gave the police a kind of license to hassle anyone on the street who was doing anything that was slightly illicit. In Chicago, there is some of that too, but there's also this notion that the rank and file police officers have been trained, and some have become community liaisons, where their job, and they've been made to understand that their job is to connect community residents with the resources that will solve problems. So it may not be that the police officer, needs to go and help fix the broken window, but they can help the block club get in touch with the Department of Buildings to say, okay, let's get this building, which is dangerous to the community, boarded up so that people will feel safer in it, and hopefully there will be fewer crimes there as well.
You know, we regularly hear reports of violence, particularly on the south side of Chicago, with the murder rate at record levels this year, appear to be on path for a record level. And is there any irony in the fact that so much of that violence that we hear about on Chicago radio or read about in the papers is occurring in some of the same neighborhoods where block clubs were first made their appearance 100 years ago?
Well, this is something that I think actually needs to be studied further. So let me say two things. One is that block clubs can only do so much, right? So block clubs are not vigilantes. They're not people who are walking around packing heat and trying to intervene in crime. That's they're you know, respectable middle-class ladies who might call the police but won't jeopardize their own safety and their family's well-being by putting themselves in the middle of crime. The other thing to say about it is that it simply hasn't been studied how block clubs can affect crime. So there are blocks where there are block clubs and there are blocks where there are no block clubs. And the question that would need to be really examined closely is, where do the crimes occur? Do they occur only on streets where there are no block clubs, or do they also occur on blocks where there are block clubs? Just to give you an example, there's a block on the south side of Chicago that where the longstanding block club calls itself the Block of Unity. And they have a lovely sign at the corner of their block that shows what houses should look like. They're all cleaned up. They're beautiful and photographed. And there was a murder on the corner of that street. And when there's a murder, you kind of expect people to cower in their homes, right? Because, oh, is there going to be more shooting? I'm going to try to protect my children. Well, the people on that block, because they were organized, poured out into the street in a demonstration that you can't do this here. So there is a possibility that block clubs can lower crime in the street where they exist. And then the question that really needs to be investigated, and I don't know what the answer to this is, do they absolutely depress crime, or do they just displace it to another block?
Boy, a great example of how there are so many more questions that can be raised through the sort of research that you do as you look back at our history.
That's definitely true, Tom. One of the things that my editors made me take out of the book, but which I felt so strongly, was that I was trying to stimulate more research. And so all over the early draft of the book, it said, for further research, somebody can go investigate this and somebody can go look at that. And they were like, no, you just have to take that out. You're counting too much on future researchers. But I really was trying to stimulate a set of questions. I really hope other people will start looking at block clubs and figure out what implications they have for how cities function.
So the name of the book is Chicago's Block Clubs, How Neighbors Shape the City. By our own Amanda Seligman, chair of the history department. We have a few minutes left, and I want to do a pivot now because, well, we've talked about the work that you've done on this book down in Chicago, and it's a fascinating read. Also want to get an update from you on a big project that is still underway here in Milwaukee. It's the Encyclopedia Milwaukee program. Professor Margot Anderson, many others at UWM are really the driving forces behind this fascinating now online look at our history. Give us an update.
Thanks, Tom. I'm always happy to have a chance to talk about the Encyclopedia of Milwaukee. We have a website that's up. We are adding new content once a week. So just on, this is going to air a month after our conversation, but I just posted the Puerto Ricans entry. We had a whole series of entries on the brewing industry that came out. And we just add a new entry every Monday so that people can learn more on a weekly basis about what happened in our city's past. We've just finished up our NEH grant, so the National Endowment for the Humanities supported the project. We've hired a whole fleet of graduate students using those funds and have probably trained two or three dozen graduate students at UWM and Marquette to do a good job writing history for the public. We've involved some 200 authors. We have probably two-thirds of the content is in one phase or another of editing, and we're still looking for authors on a couple of things.
And to find it online, where could our listeners go?
They just have to, Google Encyclopedia of Milwaukee, or it's emke.uwm.edu.
And the neat thing about this is that there is no single author, but you've actually tried to look for people who either have an interest or actual experience in some of those pages or stories from Milwaukee's history?
Yeah, it's split pretty evenly between people who are content experts who really – who literally wrote the book on one topic. We've got John Gerda wrote our entry on water, for example. And there were some topics that we wanted to bring to light that we knew people knew about but nobody had – brought together a scholarship for, and that's what we hired the graduate students for. I also have to say it's really, to me, a great example of how we involve undergraduates in our work, too. We've had a couple of undergraduates who've done a phenomenal job doing fact-checking research for us, who have learned so much and who keep telling me what a great thing it's been for their education and how they've had their lives transformed by the process of getting a chance to work on this project.
So it's an online project right now. Are there still plans to publish this in hard copy someday?
Yes, we do have a contract with Northern Illinois University Press, which is a little bit on hold right now because of the budget situation in Illinois. We're waiting to see how that shakes out. But hopefully we'll end up with a beautiful coffee table book that our friends in Illinois will help us put out on people's tables.
What's your favorite part of the encyclopedia so far?
Oh, well, I think my favorite part is probably working with those wonderful students. It's really gratifying to have the chance to develop long-term relationships with some of the most interesting people in Milwaukee who are our students at UWM. My favorite topic is Gertie the Duck, who was the mother duck who at the end of World War II laid her eggs in a very inconvenient spot and got the whole city to rally around her, helping save those ducklings.
And in fact, isn't there a memorial to Gertie downtown right now?
Yeah, just around the corner, there's a little statue of Gertie and her ducks.
Right, off of Water Street, right?
Yes, that's
Water
right.
And Wisconsin. I remember hearing those stories when I was a young boy growing up on the South Side, and I was so pleased to see that part of our message memorialized in bronze, right?
Right, and somebody might have read you that book when you were growing up. There's a children's book about Gertie the Duck.
Of course, who could have predicted that we'd also memorialize the Fonz in bronze?
That's right. And actually, we also have a wonderful entry on human-animal relations, that or pets, as they're more popularly known, done by my colleague Helena Paisior, that talks about all the different ways – this fascinating history – all the different ways in which animals have figured in Milwaukee history, including in sculpture.
Any end in sight to entries for the Encyclopedia Milwaukee?
Well, there'll be a short-term end, which is when we filled out our table of contents, we'll be like, okay, we're ready to publish the book. Okay, we can take a breath and admire what we've done. But we also want it to be an ongoing project. So when people go to see the site online, not only will they see, can they explore footnotes, so where did the content come from, but they can also leave comments for us that we can then use to iterate the next version of the Encyclopedia of Milwaukee, which we hope will be an ongoing effort.
Well, Amanda, we thank you for your visit today. You've given us two good reading assignments here over the holidays. One is the book that we talked about in the first part of the program, Chicago's Block Clubs, How Neighbors Shape the City, or That City. And then get online and take a look at Encyclopedia Milwaukee, which is our own story of how we've evolved into the community that we are today.
Thank you. I hope that people will enjoy reading those over the holidays indeed.
Amanda Seligman, chair of UWM's History Department, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week, same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.